Hey, Steve. This is Steve from Manitoba. Got the same name. I think we pretty much have the same birthday, pretty close too. I'm 52, or going to be 52 here on June 8th. And you're going to be 52, I think, towards the end of June. So I might be a week or two older than you, but pretty much same stages of life, age, that kind of thing. Though I have three kids and working on the third grandkid already. And you've just got the young kids at home. Dude, if I can offer you a bit of advice, just enjoy those kids. Enjoy those kids. They grow up way too fast. You already know, like I do, that time flies. And those kids are going to grow up fast. So, yeah, just enjoy them as much as you can. Listen, I want to thank you for your podcast. It's helped pull me through last year and a half. It's been a little difficult last year and a half. To the point where I couldn't even get on the bike. But cycling has been my therapy, and I was just at a point where I couldn't get on the bike, and it was like the perfect storm of professional issues and personal issues, and anyway, I'm back on, slowly getting back into things here. I love the adventure by bike aspect of things, touring, bikepacking. I love that. Yeah, I love the long-distance gravel, endurance gravel, and I'm about 10 kilometers south of my home right now on gravel, and love it. Glad I'm back into it. Glad I'm through that dark period, and that's thanks to you and the podcast. Really appreciated the bike packing, the cycling aspect of it, but yeah, the mental health aspect. We got to get past that stigma, right? And if you need help, get it. Anyway, I won't dwell on that. It's a beautiful day. I'm going to keep riding. And Steve, happy birthday again. And look forward to what you're going to put out next. Talk to you later. Bye.
Hello again, friends. Welcome to My Back 40 and the My Back 40 podcast. I'm your host, Steve O'Shaughnessy. Steve, thanks for your voice intro. So good to hear from you. I am just over a year older than you. I turned 53 at the end of June, as you suspected, and I don't feel a day older. I feel like $100. I feel great. It's interesting getting older, you know. I was having a conversation with some people. Actually, you know what? I'll share the entire story because I think it's a valuable story to share. I think as we age, we learn. I think sometimes, depending on your personality, we become a little bit more humble. We show a bit of humility. I was free camping somewhere, and it was like 2 or 3 in the morning. I have the worst time getting to sleep, and I was awoken in the middle of the night, about 2, 3 in the morning, well, in the middle of the morning, I guess, by a couple teenagers, pesky teenagers, who were out hanging out where I was free camping. Not just me, a whole bunch of people. And they were super loud and super belligerent. And I got upset, and I got out of the van, and I started giving them an earful. And they were saying to me, we were kind of getting into it. I wasn't being like calling them names or anything, but you know, I learned later they were in their 20s, and they were saying, "Look at you, old man with the gray hair." And yeah, all right, I guess I am kind of going gray. But anyway, after a while, I retreated. I retreated back to the van. I said, "I can't talk to you guys anymore. I can't have this conversation anymore. You're so belligerent and you're so disrespectful and blah, blah, blah." And I went back to the van. I couldn't sleep. And they were still outside and they were yapping away. It was a boy, who's about 20 years old, and a girl, she's about 24, not romantically involved, just a couple friends. And I laid there, and my coach, Sebastian, he's always telling me, what do you want to create? Or he's asking me, what do you want to create, Steve? In every moment of every day, you have the opportunity to create, whether it be a moment with your children, a moment with a love interest, a moment with family, however that may look. And I laid there and I said, what do I want to create in this moment? And you know what I wanted to create is peace. I wanted to create some peace. I actually felt bad about the way I showed up. And so I got out of the van in my underwear, no less, and a t-shirt. and I walked over. There's a bench kind of nearby where I was sleeping, and I sat on the bench beside them and I said, "Hey, I want to apologize to you guys. I was a fucking asshole." Well, you show up at 3 a.m. and you're super loud and you're being super belligerent, and I got upset, and that wasn't the best way to navigate that, and I'm sorry. And I apologized to them, and they apologized to me for being belligerent. And they were polluted. They were so drunk. And we ended up having a really fantastic conversation. I mean, I was old enough to be their father, right? Which is maybe why I got out, and I was a dick. I was so upset. And it's like, you know, in the grand scheme of things, one, it was probably unsafe for me to jump out of the van and give them a hard time. I assessed the situation. I didn't feel unsafe when I confronted them the first time, but it turns out they were two, First Nations kids from the adjacent reservation. And we had such a fantastic conversation about their life, about kind of what they see, what their experience has been, you know, as young kids growing up in this world. And you know, people who, pay a little bit of attention to what's going on in Canada right now in terms of the history of residential schools and the mass graves they're finding of children, in some of the provinces, in our nation. It's just, it's horrible. There's horrible things happening, and it's causing a lot of these kids, and the Indigenous people just trauma. It's horrible. Could you imagine? And this isn't, you know, hundreds of years ago. This is like just within the last couple generations, even a single generation, really. And anyway, I know that's kind of a grim way to start, but I think what I'm trying to convey is just like, how do you want to show up every day, and how do you want to create your life, and how do you want to create relationships with the people that you encounter? And I didn't show up well in that moment, and I took accountability for that, and I turned that around, and I wanted to, you know, I didn't know how they were going to receive my apology, my extension of the olive branch, if you will, but it was well received. And like I say, it was a great conversation. We probably wrapped up around 3:30, 3:45 in the morning, to be honest. And I didn't get a lot of sleep that night, but the experience that I had, turning things around and showing up in that way, more than made up for the lack of sleep I had. So I guess going back, Steve, thanks for your voice intro. Thank you for your voice intro yet. And if you want to record me one, whip out your device, record me something, and send it to myback40podcast@gmail.com. I'm glad you're finding value in the podcast. I'm glad that the things that I share and the experiences of the guests and the stories from the guests that I'm sharing on the podcast are having some impact. And I think that this medium is important. I think the idea of having long format conversations with people is so important. And I think messages and information and wisdom can be shared so much more effectively when you have the time and space around a conversation to unpack the things, the topics that get covered. And I'm in the habit of going into conversations cold. And because my MO for the podcast has always been conversational. I don't like calling them interviews. I find that so formal. I like to sit down with someone as if I'm going to have a beer with them or a coffee or what have you, just to sit down and learn about someone's life and meander through the topics as they arise, as they emerge from the conversation. I just think that that's so much more fun. It's really fun for me to do that. And what I find that there always seems to be some lesson learned from the guest. And it could be a takeaway like, wow, I never thought that person have had experienced the same, say, level of trauma that I have, or had the same upbringing as I had, or wow, I can't believe that in this case, I can't believe that person dropped out of school at 15 years of age and later became a pro tour cyclist, right? Like, everybody has a story here. Everybody has a story out there in the world. And it doesn't matter if it's some, you know, person you've never heard of, or someone like Svein Tuft, who crushed the BC Epic 1000 in 2 days and 2 hours, right? It's everyone has a great story. And I think what's great about this conversation is, you know, talking to a dude that's come from a pro cycling career, and to hear him tell stories about, you know, how he suffered and the challenges he faced on something like the BC Epic. I mean, Svein won the Buckshot in May, and he rode, what was it, 381 kilometers, and it's a day ride for that guy, right? You know, Megan won it the day before, or the day before, the year before, in about 18 hours, and Svein accomplished the same thing, and that was his first dirt bikepacking event, and to hear the lessons he learned from this, and to hear how it impacted his life and how it made him feel accomplished and masterful at his craft, and the idea of doing hard things and how important that is to the human condition is and it's just, there's parallels, right, between all these athletes. I mean, I just put a podcast out with Megan Häkkinen, right, who finished the divide in 15 days and 22 hours. And it's like, I'd never be able to finish it in 15 days. Well, maybe I should never say never, I suppose. But, you know, all these athletes who are participating and crushing these events, they have the same experience as the people who are out there for a month. And as I've said before, it's like, you know, Justinus was saying that the people who are out there for longer than the 2 week finishers or the 13 day finishers, they're the heroes. They're actually the heroes of the event. The people who are suffering the most, who are the people who are out there the longest, and it really makes sense. But I digress. I'm kind of all over the place right now. It's 11:45. I can't really sleep. I felt like talking on the mic. I felt like getting a podcast out. And Svein and I connected very last minute here this evening, and it was great. It was a great conversation. So good to connect with him. And going back to the voice intro thing, the voice memo thing, people send, whip out your device, record me something, and send it to mybike40podcast@gmail.com, and I'll get it on the show, just like this one. But I'm really glad that people are finding takeaways with the podcast. It's so important to me, and that's really why I do it. I mean, you know, it's a side hustle for me. It's something I so enjoy doing. The podcast has been, I've been, what are we in now? 168 or something? Is that what number this one is? I'll have to check. But ever since I started podcasting back from Bikepack Canada, I found so much joy in connecting with people from all walks of life. And then the reason I wanted to take the podcast in a different direction, away from Bikepack Canada, and it's still focused on endurance cycling and endurance athletics and training and nutrition, and then, you know, the emergence of men's mental health through all of it, I love endurance cycling. I love riding a bike, and it's just an important part of my life. I mean, for all the changes that I've had in my life, cycling has always been there. It's always been the tried and true thing that I love to do. And, you know, it's evolved over time from, you know, riding a Triple Crown fork and a hardtail in the Whistler Mountain Bike Park before it was the bike park it is now. I've been biking a long time, and the park is a different beast now, to you know, trail riding, to going up to Alaska to the single speed world championships, to starting bikepacking events and endurance cycling. It's just been this constant evolution of cycling for me, and cycling has always been important to me. But Steve had mentioned the how cycling had fallen out of favor for him based on his mental health at the time. And I've had that same experience where you're just not feeling it. You're not feeling the motivation. You're not feeling the energy. Mental health can be so detrimental to our day to day. And when we get into those low states of mental health, I think that the amount of energy it takes existing in a depressive state can really take the joy out of life. I play music. I'm a musician, singer, guitar player, mediocre at best, I suppose. But I enjoy it. It fills me up. Performing for people and singing for people and writing songs and singing to my girlfriend. And it means a lot to me. It fills me up. And especially when it fills them up, you know, when you're performing musically for someone and it's you're putting yourself out there. It's actually a true form of authenticity and vulnerability is, you know, because if you're not confident in your playing ability or your singing ability, you're really putting it out there, you know. But when music falls aside, I usually know something's up. I'm not feeling the joy. And in the past, I've said before that it's like, no, I need to bring the joy in. I need to keep playing. But it's hard when you're in a depressive state. It can really take away your creative spark, you know. It can really take that away. And I think in those moments, it's best to just give yourself grace, especially when it comes to cycling, or any sport or whatever you're passionate about. Sometimes you just have to give yourself grace and rest and take a break and ground yourself again. I'd responded to someone's thread. They never responded to me. I kind of expected to be kind of pushed back against on the comment I made, but someone was saying that, and Steve says it in his voice message, you know, bikes are therapy. Riding a bike can be therapy. And I do agree. I think getting after it, being physical, exercising, movement through nature, all the things that I push on the podcast, I push them all the time, how important it is to be active. And 98% of the time, if I'm feeling down and I go out for a ride and I come back, a lot of times I do feel better. I feel attenuated. There's time to think, there's time to reconcile when you're out there. But sometimes an activity like cycling, I just need to go for a 3-hour ride. I need to go. I'll feel better when I get back. Sometimes that's just a mask. I'm not equating them. I'm not putting these things on the same scale, but, drugs and alcohol help people with, mitigating their depression, masking their depression for a certain amount of time until they sober up and it comes back again. Right. And then you drink again and it attenuates it a little bit longer. It puts it aside. It puts that, those thoughts and that stuff on the back burner. And then you sober up and it comes back again, you know, alcohol, cannabis, whatever, pick your drug. And I think sometimes cycling can be like that too. You can go out for a hammer. Man, I went out for a tear the other day. I haven't had the best month on a lot of different levels. A lot of me problems, to be honest. Negative self-talk and telling myself stories and all that kind of thing. And you know, the amount of times I preach, you know, the idea of, you know, being mindful around your thoughts. And I'm not really a meditator. I have picked up the journaling again very, very recently. I don't know what I'm doing, but I do find that sometimes getting the thoughts out help a lot. But what I said in this thread, I go back, I digress, I'm doing it again. But what I said in this thread is like, sometimes I think it's valuable to maybe dive in or learn the why of your depression. If you're constantly needing a sport or a substance or sitting down on the couch playing video games or whatever to mask whatever's going on in your head, I think sometimes you need to take some time to maybe sit in silence and think about why you're so depressed, why why you're feeling this way. So I think it's really important to, I think I give Steve credit for having, you know, maybe it wasn't intentional for him, but having being mindful around his depression and maybe not masking it with riding the bike all the time. It's like, you have to give yourself grace. So I don't know if that any of that really made any sense, but I think it's easy to hide behind things, like using an activity or a substance to hide what you're feeling inside. And sometimes what's best, and I'll tell you, I won't get into a lot of specifics, but I fell apart the other day, and I have a good friend that I talk to quite often. And I sent this person a very lengthy voice message, very lengthy. And what I needed in that moment was just to talk into space. I needed to just talk into space and just regurgitating ideas, regurgitating thoughts, regurgitating what I was feeling in that moment and the stories I was telling myself, and acknowledging that I was being self-deprecating, but just, I was just feeling it so deeply and on such a deep level. But just to take that moment and talk into space, to my friend, and not even that friend wasn't even in the same room, but trusting that, there's always space held for me to be able to do that with that person, is so important. And, in another part of, Steve actually sent me 3 different voice messages actually. So I used this one 'cause it was the best quality, but he made light of something I said about, men reaching out to other men or people, let's just say people, 'cause I know a lot of men listen to this podcast, and I know there's a few women that listen to it. My demo is definitely male. But I always talk about the idea of having someone to talk to and reach out to and be that one person, be the person. I know it's hard to put yourself out there and be the one that reaches out to people to talk about mental health and to reach out to a friend to talk about it. But, if no one's doing it, you be the one to do it. Like I'm the one to do it. I get nothing but value and at the risk of sometimes at the risk of maybe burdening the person I'm leaning on too much. I still think that, you know, if someone loves and cares about you enough, they're going to listen and they're going to get back to you. So it's like, I guess what I'm getting at in this crazy long monologue is to, don't rely on exercise and substances to be the mask for your depression. It can be a false positive when you think you're dealing with things by going for a long bike ride. 'Cause sometimes you need to delve a bit deeper than that and get to the why of the depression and, or the why, not even depression, the why of your suffering, if you will. Sometimes it's good to dive in and get to the why of that. And if that means sitting in silence, reconciling with yourself and journaling and whatnot, that's one thing. Or if it means reaching out to a friend or sitting with a loved one or a family member and just being honest and vulnerable with that person, it can really help. So, I don't know if any of that really makes any sense, but I just wanted to share that. Anyway, this is a great conversation with Svein Tuft, who crushed the BC Epic in two days and 2 hours. Now, Svein is an ex-pro tour rider. He rode on several different teams. I'm going to put it all in the show notes. And I admitted to him when I reached out to him, he's like, you know what? The whole pro tour thing and Tour de France and Giro d'Italia, all that stuff's not in my wheelhouse. You know, it's really not in my wheelhouse. But we don't dive too deeply into that. We do talk about his childhood, his coming up through the ranks to become a pro rider, what it means to be a pro rider, what the pressures are like, riding at that level, what it's like to ride as a team, with the same goal, you know, to succeed as a team, And then we delve into children a little bit and fatherhood. And then we talked about the BC Epic. And this was a really great conversation. Like I said, it's fairly cold. I always go in cold. But I think there's a lot of great info in here. And it was a pleasure talking with Svein. He's a really, really good dude. We were connected. He was in Nelson. He was outside sitting, and just over time as we talked, it just got darker and darker, and eventually I couldn't see him anymore. And really, it really nailed the idea of how video chat, when we're talking back and forth, if we can't be in the same room together, video is the next best thing, because as soon as I couldn't see his face anymore, I could feel the flow get kind of, I had to work harder to keep the flow because I couldn't see his face. I couldn't read his mannerisms and his micro expressions to, you know, for proper conversational flow. So got a bit challenging at the end, but still fantastic conversation with a fantastic dude, Svein Tuft. And I want to just get to the podcast right now. So without further delay, I bring you Svein Tuft. Hey, Svein.
Hey,
how you doing? Oh, great just, audio, buddy. That sounds great.
Just a second here.
Yeah, no worries.
Get set up outside. Yeah, doing good. How about yourself?
Oh, really well. How's recovery? I could see it in your eyes, dude.
Yeah, I mean, it's special, eh? Like, it's a damage I can't say I've experienced in my life before. So,
is that right?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what I used to do before was very, very recovery based, you know. So, like a grand tour, yeah, you're racing 21 days, but you know, you might race a big stage is 220, 240,
yeah,
but then you're immediately in the bus getting like recovery food and putting the legs up and getting a massage back at the hotel and you know all that stuff. So.
I was explaining to someone the other day there, we were talking about Lachlan Wharton's ride of the Tour de France, right? Like when he beat everyone to the finish, right? Riding all the stages and all the transfers. And then when he explained to people like the idea of ultra endurance, unsupported bike packing, it's like, you know, they don't have the masseuse and the chefs and, you know, all and the great air conditioned bus or whatever hotel room that you get to sleep in. You know, you're sleeping in ditches, which is maybe why you did it in two days. Right. So you didn't have to. Did you sleep at all on the Epic?
I did. Yeah. So I have some funny stories there, but
love to hear them.
You know, again, new territory for me.
Yeah.
Like, Are you recording right now? Do you want
to? You know what? I should have told you. I record right off the top. So I don't know if you listen to the podcast. My MO is very conversational, very shoot the shit.
Okay.
Like we're sitting on your deck outside right now. Just
sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the sleep thing, totally new to me. I was really just kind of let's see what happens. You know, I leaned on a few people that I know who do this kind of thing, like my friend Rob Britton. Uh-huh. So I take a lot of what he says to heart because I know he's done some pretty epic stuff. And
of course.
I basically, you know, I know the first day push, you should be able to get through that, no problem. And then I'd planned to sleep on the ferry, but like that whole thing was like, it was funny because I'd written off making the 240 ferry. I was kind of like, well, just relax, you know, like catch the next one. Don't rush so much. But as I got closer into Nelson, I started realizing that it was all going to work out. So I was like kind of time trialing out to Balfour. Got some food just before the ferry. So it was kind of like that ferry goes by much quicker than you'd want at that point. Like I was kind of hoping it was just a 2-hour ferry ride. But yeah, you know, setting up and then trying to charge things, and it's a very small window while you're out there, and so I probably caught like maybe 10 minutes of shut eye there, and then I was, you know, quickly like, wow, just back to reality and kind of wrapping things up on the other side and slowly creeping up Grey Creek Pass, and so just kept pushing. And, you know, get through that whole next section, wild weather. Grey Creek Pass was rough because it had rained so much and was raining so much that, you know, to add to the difficulty of that climb, you now have this kind of spongy sludge that you're, you know, pushing extra watts just to make it up the bloody thing.
And
make it down there, and I'm, you know, get off that descent and just stoked to make it to that Kimberley bike path, cruising like, you know, that's all. It's like a paved, beautiful bike path, and it's like kind of tailwinds. You know, it's late at night, or probably morning at this point. Rolled into Cranbrook, pretty out of it. There's just one 24-hour Husky. Did a little stock up there, and then started cruising towards the Chief Isidore trail system there, and which I have ridden and is awesome. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's pitch black, and the weather's pretty iffy.
And you're riding an RV. You're basically riding a Winnebago.
Yeah.
On the single track.
Exactly. The other times I'd ridden it, much different setup. So I really, at this point, actually coming off of the descent off of Gray Creek, I started first having my little bit of, I would say, minor hallucinations at that point. So I guess the only way to explain it is I started noticing the brain and the eyes is playing tricks all the time, right? And every object seemed like it was some kind of creature of some kind, not in a scary way or like, oh shit way. It was just like, it was just something that looked, you know, your brain was like, oh, is that a deer? And as you got closer, you would look at the thing and you're just like, how was I thinking that was a deer or a bear or whatever, right? You're just, your brain is just doing some, and I don't know what the evolutionary explanation is for that. But it was wild. And so I really started getting that in a very deep sense, getting close to that trail. And I'm just like, you know what? It would be much better if I just shut her down for a bit here. And so I pulled over in a nice little, underneath a little pine tree there, and rolled out the emergency blanket and set the alarm for an hour. And I swear to you, that hour, like, it was as if it was a couple seconds. Cause like as soon as I got in that thing, it was just so nice. And I shut down and then boom, the alarm was going off. And that's kind of probably, I would say, like, one of the nastiest moments is trying to
when the alarm crawl went off.
Out of that. Yeah. And just like going like, oh yeah. So now I'm going to, okay. So yeah, you try and muster up some motivation and get after it again. So that was amazing though, because it truly was a reset. It's not great. It's not like you feel awesome, but the brain was working again, and I wasn't having these kind of crazy hallucinations, which were never extreme. They were never bad, or it wasn't like it was hindering you in any way. It was just like you were just extremely tired, but just all these objects were just, yeah, it was just too much going on, really.
Well, you and I don't know each other. I've ridden the BC Epic 3 times. I was the first guy to yo-yo it, and not,
oh wow,
not the fastest. Not the fastest. I did that in 2021.
Wow.
And in 2022 I rode the Divide.
So I'm
awesome. Very familiar with the BC Epic route, and I'm very familiar with what you're talking about hallucinations. For me, I was riding through Wardner, and it was like 2 a.m.
Wardner.
Yeah. And I was in the woods, and I kept looking off to the side because it felt like I was riding through townhomes, and I could see windows with lamps and lights. And then you'd look, and because you're just kind of following your tunnel, right? You're just in the green tunnel, and you can't really see anything else. And so I relate to the hallucinations. And another experience I had along that stretch leading into Nelson on the return leg was the sleep monster just coming in, and it was just like the narrowing of vision, narrow, and then so it's just a pinpoint, and then it's off, and you're alert, and you can feel your balance, and you can feel yourself moving through space, and then you can almost feel the bike like leaning off, it's like, huh, and you kind of wake up. It's so dangerous. It's so dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I just wanted to relate to you. So like I've been like in those places where pushing through the night and not as rapid as you. Yeah. When I first did the epic, it was like 4 days and 4 hours for me, which was great for me. Like for, you know, I'm
far
a little
more enjoyable.
Well, yeah, I'm a little older than you. on the yo-yo, I was it was in 2021. It was like 40 degrees in Summerland, right? It was that.
Oh, yeah.
That really that crazy. Yeah, so I flipped and I was riding nights. I was like sleeping in the air conditioning during the day, and it didn't work because it just fucked up my circadian rhythm, right? So I mean, it worked.
Yeah,
but man, it was just so hot. It's just such a it's epic. It's an epic ride.
That that point right there, I think, is really awesome because no matter how well prepared you are, fitness wise, equipment wise, all those things, what you just said is like, I don't think you ever get a perfect run, right? It's like that notion of skipping the heat of the day and sleeping.
Seemed like a good idea.
Just like you said. Yeah, like your circadian rhythm gets shot and then you're just all over the place and like getting really tired at weird moments. Like, so yeah, it is epic.
And I just run better in the cool. Like I'm not a skinny guy. Yeah. Like I'm kind of a burly Irishman, right? So when it gets hot, I'm just like, I'm a mess. Yeah. I get swollen. Yeah, it's horrible. But you have a vast. I have your wiki up here as well. You have quite a vast road riding career, like an amazing. And I like I told you when we chatted, it's out of my wheelhouse. It honestly, it truly is. I think I followed the tour during the Lance Armstrong days. I've had Tyler Hamilton on the podcast a couple times.
Oh wow!
Yeah, great guy to talk to. Super fun.
So
tell me about I was just reading it here. You dropped out of school at 15, and what was your plan? Like why did you drop out? Where were you in life at that point when you were 15 years old?
Oh, I had no plans. It was a beautiful time. I don't recommend to kids dropping out of school, but if I look back in my life, I did it for the right reasons, you know. I think some kids drop out of school because of whatever, they're hanging out with the wrong crowd or whatever. But for me, I think I was hanging with the right crowd. I had friends who were mountain climbing and getting after it, doing expeditions, and that's all I wanted to do. So it was very clear to me that school was like a jail for me. I would be in a beautiful day inside, looking out the window, just going like, what am I doing here? You know, this was the worst. And that whole thing of like getting up into the mountains, it just changed it. My life changed forever from that point on. And I had no real ambition for anything, like other than just doing trips and seeing the world and all that stuff. And through that, I found bikes because traveling any other way became awfully expensive. And I was always kind of doing these like the minimum amount of work that I could to kind of keep doing my trips and expeditions, you know. So that was back in the day when, you know, like $50 went a long ways. You know, if you went hay baling, you know, for an evening and you pulled $50, I mean, I was set for a couple weeks, you know. And I had such a cool, like, I had some great friends, and I was kind of just bumming around. And my parents, they divorced at that time, so they weren't speaking a lot. So it was kind of bad in a way because I was kind of playing them off each other. So they never really knew where I was. But finding the bike was huge because then I realized I could get out to the mountains under my own power, and that changed everything. The bike. So I started doing my first trips. You know, back in the day, my first big trip was up to Bella Coola. I had my dog with me. I built a trailer so I could take all my equipment. I wanted to go climbing. I wanted to just go see the Chilcotins and then see Bella Coola. And all of a sudden, it came from like that realization of the freedom of a bicycle, having all of your stuff, and just being able to go like where you're legs can take you. That was it. That, so, you know, always mountains have been my kind of passion. I love being in the mountains and all those things. But at that point, just riding and having like all of your stuff, that just changed me, the freedom of it. And so then I did a few trips up to Alaska. And this is like, yeah, it would have been like 17, 18 on my first trips way up there.
This is like early, just late, mid to late 90s kind of thing. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. Cassiar Highway was still huge sections of gravel, you know? Yeah. And I learned so much on those trips. And I always say to this day, like there's no way I could replicate that same feeling I got, you know, like in life, sometimes you have these great memories of these things that you would love to be able to go doing again. And it was just different times, you know, like we didn't have phones and all of these things that distract us. Like I was truly like living the life, and I'm almost jealous of that guy now because of the lack of distraction that I had. You know, that was the day you bought a phone card, and I would make a call back to my mom every, you know, every couple of weeks, be like, oh yeah, I'm in Nome, Alaska. Yeah. Have a quick chat, and that was it. And I had books, you know, like I would want to ride big days, but like if I was totally screwed, I would just find a sweet, you know, you're riding through these beautiful places, you pull up on a river and read a book and cook some food and just take her easy, you know. It was such a great moment of my life, and I know I can't go back to that now. I have family and obligations and responsibilities and all those things, so I'm very glad I got that moment of my life. But getting how I came to the road thing, it was basically I would do odd jobs to like pay for my trips, and now I was getting like thinking like, oh, South America, that was going to be like my next trips. And I was working at a friend's shop that was like a secondhand sports store kind of thing, but it was big emphasis on bikes. And my dad, like, who I wasn't really like at, like through that whole period, I wasn't like, we were kind of not talking a lot. But this was a period we really started like hanging out a lot more, because I was in one place for, you know, that winter. I was just working and living at that shop underneath the stairwell. So yeah, it was a pretty, pretty sweet gig for me, because I had everything I needed. Once again, good life, you know, with nothing. But my dad and I, we would be hanging out, and this was where I tried out a Cannondale road bike with Spinergy wheels, you know, so like one of the fastest road bikes at the time. And up to that point, I'd been pulling like riding a mountain bike with a trailer, and
and now you're on like these, a super light, fast, nimble, crazy. Yeah.
Crazy, where the energy transfer is just like instant. You know. Yeah, and you're putting that same power that you put into your other rig, that same power you'd be doing like 18K an hour. Now on this thing you're doing like 40K an hour. And it's just like my mind was blown. I rode up to Mount Baker and I was just like, this is the coolest thing ever. So my dad, he's Norwegian, and he kind of grew up with like a lot of Euro sports. He always loved like the Tour de France. I didn't know that I knew, but I didn't really, it wasn't anything I related to, because I wasn't a sports fan or any kind of, you know, if I saw the tour or whatever, I just thought it looked crazy, looked a bit ridiculous to me. But my grandfather in Norway used to race bikes and also cross country skiing. So anyways, my dad saw that I like was interested in something that he could relate to for the first time, and so we started piecing together just like a crazy Franken bike, you know, like all the bits and pieces around the shop that we could find, and we put together a race bike, and then I just started doing these races. And because I'd been riding like for basically
ever
4 years towing a trailer, yeah. And like, yeah, the it just immediately applied to racing, and I had no skill, I had no understanding of how races work, But if the course suited me and my equipment held together, I did very well. So I progressed through the ranks. And, you know, like anything, when you kind of excel at things, it becomes kind of exciting, you know, it becomes interesting if you're good at something and the work is paying off. So that kind of became my new obsession. And then, man, like, it's crazy, but like, then it was 20 years from that point on. It was like 20 something years of just giving her on a road bike and trying to figure out how to make it, you know?
Well, it's something so gratifying, right? When you discover something like I was pushed into as a kid, it was like pushed into T-ball and, all the team sports, right? My dad played hockey, coached hockey. I could barely skate to this day. I just didn't take to it. I didn't like it. But then as soon as I discovered individual sports, skiing, snowboarding, mountain biking, et cetera, et cetera, it's like, that's where, and that's kind of what I'm trying to teach my boy, because he hates phys ed, hates team sports, is not interested. I'm like, dude, I skateboarded. I rode bikes. Yeah. It's like, because
same skateboarding.
Yeah. Awesome. It's like, I'm not interested in being on a team and supporting a team. It's for me, it was all about self-expression, you know, which is what skateboarding pretty much is, right? Is self-expression. And so when you discover something that you're semi good at, I competed at snowboarding. I was pretty good at it back in Ontario, and it ended up moving west. And, but when you find something you're good at and you feel masterful at that, it's such a fire in your belly, right? It just makes you, it drives you to do better and better. So, and the races aren't, they're not as much of, they're not really much about the for me anyway, it wasn't as much about the competition as it was to learn and to see better at ride. Like, you get faster. Like, when I moved to Invermere, I was okay fitness, but I got fit chasing fast guys around the woods, right? You just ride with people who are better than you. You try to keep up with them.
Absolutely.
Right? And then before you know it, you're riding with them. Like, you're on their wheel and you can actually ride and keep up. And there's something so gratifying in that. So through that, entering races, how does it work? Do you get discovered? Like, you get scouted? Like, some team manager's like, oh my God, look at that Spain guy. Holy shit, we need him on our team. Is that kind of the way it works?
Yeah, it's a great question, and like something that I try and work with younger folks to figure out. But I really think it's still, I think, like, a lot of people think there's some magic, you know, like, oh, having the right connections and all that stuff, but the road world's still pretty old school in that sense. And I always say, like, just make yourself known. So
big, show up
by
big.
That I mean yeah, like, you every race you give, like even if it's a local small race, you know, because I talk to a lot of young guys and they're like, oh, I need to get to Europe and all these things. And I'm like, well, what do you do? And you're like, how's it going, the local race? And they're like, oh, everyone marks me and everyone's out to race against me because I'm the strongest guy. And it's like, well, you need to be like lapping the field and the criteriums. You need
don't
to
let
be
them
like,
catch you.
You need to be winning by like 10 minutes if you want to go to Europe and actually compete, because it's a different world over there.
Yeah,
nothing to take away from these guys, but it's just like the attitude for me was like, if you're like in the Pacific Northwest or in like Western Canada and part of the States, if you're showing up at every race and doing like having an impact, you get talked about. And then, you know, when I came up, it was a much healthier racing scene than in North America than what it has happened now. So
can you explain that? Can you explain that?
Yeah. So at that time there was a lot of professional teams and there was a lot more professional races. And so what happened was we had like these Tour of Californias, Tour of Utahs, Tour of Colorados. They all came and they were part of this like big organization. And when COVID hit, they all kind of just pulled back and things that crushed a lot of things, because what happened was those were televised races that brought a huge amount of life to North America, because the World Tour teams from Europe would come. They saw value in coming to race the Tour of California, for example. And so what that brought was a lot of health to the domestic teams, because now they could go to a sponsor and say, like, we're going to do Tour California and Tour Colorado, and it's going to have this many viewers and all of these things that you can kind of sell to a sponsor. And when those races died, sponsors are like, also with COVID, a lot of things changed in the marketing side of things and in the whole industry too. So it's kind of been this really negative downfall where it's just Criterium Racing left, not a lot of big road set, like stage racing and things like this. So yeah, I was lucky. I came up in a time when it was quite healthy and there was a lot of good, strong teams. So I got signed to a very good team very early on, which, you know, helped progress my, you know, my development and learning to get to like the next level, which was like going to Europe or whatever. But it's just not like that anymore. So it's a lot tougher to make it from North America. But I came in at a very lucky time.
Like, could a talented cyclist, a young talented cyclist, literally move to Europe and try to make it there and start, you know, yeah, in that way, or is there kind of a coming of age where you have to kind of pay your dues, you know, in your country of origin before you're noticed?
It's that whole template has changed a lot because they're looking at so many young riders, and I've heard like a 23-year-old say, I'm getting too old, I haven't made it pro yet, I'm gonna quit. And you're just like, man, I didn't turn actually pro. Like, I raced a lot enjoying my life, and I raced professional races up until, so I turned actual pro at like 31, like where I was racing in Europe.
Yeah.
So like I came very late, like I started racing at the age of 24. So like when I hear those stories, I'm like, well, you know, like if you're good, teams don't care how old you are. You know, obviously they're not going to take the risk to sign a guy who just comes out of nowhere, 38 years old and is really strong. But if you can win races, they don't care how old you are. Like, that's nonsense, you know? So that's one side of it. And then two, your first question, about a kid just going over to Europe and trying to figure it out. Yeah, you can do that, but it's extremely hard because the level of racing here in Canada and the US, it's just different. And the rhythm and the distance, it's so much shorter and so much of a less of a load. So you would have to really kind of go there and have a program or be with an amateur type team in France or Italy or something and have like 2 years of ability to stay there and just live that life. So not a lot of people can do that because it is 2 years. To be honest, it's 2 years to get your stuff figured out over there. Because your first year, you're basically just getting beaten up. You're like, even the best guys, you talk to a lot of the good guys like that have to come from Australia or US or Canada. For everyone, unless you're just like one of these super freaks, which, you know, there's not that many of, for most guys, it's an all out struggle just to survive that first year. And that's what kind of makes a lot of people pull the plug and say, no, it's not for me, you know?
Yeah, it's also not really about, it's not just about being fit and fast, right? It's about, and in cycling, I mean, it's about working with a team, right? And knowing how to play within that group of riders and play fair. And I mean, you're seeing a lot of that. I mean, I'm seeing that a little bit more. There's a little bit more of that road vibe going into gravel now, right? Where you're seeing you're seeing that because you're getting that influx of UCI pros going into gravel and just crushing these races. But you can when you watch the races, you can see them. Like, it's just like you're watching Tour de France on dirt, basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's always my fear, that these cool gravel races were going to become more of a road race, and essentially that's what they are, you know? So yeah, that's the nature of it, you know, where there's that attraction, where there's sponsorship money, where there's like people are looking, that's just inevitable, right? The industry gets behind it and then the level just keeps getting pushed up and up, right?
What kind of pressure? Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like you said, there's so much more to that life. Like you said, it's a really good point. Yeah, it's great to be, you know, a physical specimen on a bike, but there's so much more to that life too that you have to figure out and navigate, and it's not easy. I don't, you know, like I think of so many guys go over there and they're miserable. Like I used to see guys move into these crappy cell block apartments, you know, to save money, and they'd just be sitting there playing video games all day when they weren't training. And I'm like, that's not a life. You got to make a life here, right? It's no wonder you're pining to go home, because you haven't created. This is one opportunity you get. You're like, to get to go and live in Europe and live that life, you make the most of it, because it, you can have an injury and not get signed, and boom, like within a year, it's over. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to just that, right? Making it pro is, yeah, there's a lot of other facets to it. So,
so as a young cyclist entering that pro tour type of cycling, what does it feel like? What are the pressures like entering that world?
Well, just making it, making an impact, like you spoke earlier. I always say to guys, find your niche, right? Unless you're a guy who can guaranteed win like 10 races a year, you better find out what you can provide for that team. Because even say if you're a guy who can win 10 races a year, which is a very, very, like, that's a really good year for some of the best guys. It's not like on a 30-man team, you only might have a few guys that are capable of that, or maybe only one. So you got to think, like, there's a good 20 others that are there to support those wins, right? And cycling is crazy because, you know, I think of some of the best moments I've had on a bike in racing. It's actually more about what we did as a team rather than a personal result or, you know, like whatever, your own achievements. It's amazing what you can do as a group, but like it only comes from the buy-in from every person in that group. And, you know, I was never a team sports guy. I'm a massive introvert. I like to do things on my own. But man, there was some real power in like when you got a group all on board and everyone chipped in to make the impact on that, whatever the plan was, whether like that's a great feeling of being a human right there. So, you know, that became my new, the thing that I think drove me all those years was just being part of those big moments, you know. And I was lucky. I was on a great team that really, really captured that, really was able to get that, because it was amazing, you know, like these guys that on paper weren't the big names, but you get everyone on board and they do stuff that just blows your mind, right? Like you just never would have expected. And that was, you know, I think back, probably some of my best memories are, you know, things like team time trials or where we just had a crazy plan for the day. Like just, you know, something that sounded crazy when you're sitting in the race meeting and you're just like looking at the other guys like, you know, like that, are we going to be able to do this, you know? And everyone buys in and you pull it off. It's like, yeah, I think that's what really kind of drove me all those years to really love that sport and do it as long as I did.
Explain what that looks like. What does that plan look like? So how far is the time trial, say, that your team time trial?
They're all over the place. Sometimes 16K to like...
Oh, super short.
Or 55K, you know, right. Like it's very, very random depending on the area of the course and all that kind of stuff. So,
So a plan would be, say, you know, you've got the rider that you want to basically finish, like win that stage, that time trial. And then the rest of the team, what does the support plan look like for that one member that's designated as the line crosser?
Yeah. So like in a team time trial, it's every man. So how does a team move the fastest compared to all the other teams? You know, like I saw it very often, teams that had big name time trialers quite often blew up. they were not as, like, on paper, they should have just rocked everyone. But it was because they had big guys, big egos, guys who were out there to kind of show. So what all they ended up doing was beating up on their other guys. But in order to go fast with an 8 or 9 man team, is you need everyone to understand their actual roles, their abilities. And that's very hard to do in a group of like young men, right? Because
old men, come on, let's be serious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's testosterone involved, there's ego involved, there's all of these things, right? And so that, you know, I think back to my Green Edge days, the Australian team, we had a bunch of guys that's what we did. We did training camps together. We lived together. We lived and breathed that event. Because there was a big focus those years at the World Championships as well. And we just became a dialed unit. And it was because we understood very well our weakest link and our strongest link, how we could make everyone kind of work synergistically to just be the fastest. It's not about who's the strongest or who can, you know, lift the pace by 5K. Well, when you do that, all you're doing is screwing the guy who just did his turn and was already hanging on for dear life. And now he's like sprinting to get back onto the back, you know? So it's a very technical event. That's one of the things I love about it, but it's also this kind of holistic view of how people work and understanding people at that level is, I don't know. For me, that's why I love that event, because it's just beautiful in that way.
Yeah, it's like having a plan and then executing it perfectly and then having it all just come together. It must just be you know, give you goosebumps. So right now.
In those meetings, you can create all these scenarios, all of these different things that happen, but in the end you just need the guys to understand instinctually how to handle each bit, and that's time and working together and all of these things that are hard to just tell someone or teach someone, right? You have to feel it and live it. And that's why I used to laugh, because the sports scientists would come in and start giving all their tips and advice, and I'd be looking at them like,
that doesn't work in real life.
mate, you don't know what that feels like at 65K an hour. Like, what are you talking about? You know?
Yeah, that's funny. I noticed too, I read here, this is something I kind of learned like in my very brief following of Pro Tour, like Tour de France cycling, was the importance of the domestique, which I see that you were a domestique. So when I would see, you know, these teams and groups riding, and then some dude would basically be taking orders. What do you need? Water, food, what do you need? And then he drops way back, oftentimes way back to a team car, and then loads up on how many kilograms of stuff. Right, like bottles of water and food and whatnot, and then back through the field to the team, and then hands it all out. So I would say that I think the domestiques are like the unsung heroes of the team, really.
Absolutely, and that goes back to that finding your niche, you know, finding what you can provide for the team. But I will say, you know, like getting bottles and food and stuff, that's actually the easy part of that job, believe it or not. Like it's. There's so much going on in a bike race. If you have a really good climber or GC guy, you're switched on from kilometer zero until you can't pedal any further. And
you're wasted, right? I've seen that too. And then the guy just peels off the back. He's like, his job's done.
Yeah. So the goal of, if you have a guy who's capable of winning the Tour de France, is like, the goal is that guy never touches the wind. Because he needs, like, if you understand how hard a Grand Tour is, he needs every ounce of energy for when he actually has to do the hard yards, the real work, right? So, you know, you're constantly around that guy, looking after him. Anytime he needs to move up, anytime, you know, there's a climb coming up, he needs to start at the front to conserve energy. Well, nowadays in World Tour racing, that's like a field sprint used to be back in the day. To get your guy to the front of a climb is an all-out war. And, you know, when you watch on TV, it doesn't look like much. But you don't realize, like, the guys who are out in the wind to get to the base of that climb, they're pushing, like, 500 watts.
Oh, my God.
And
for how long?
Like, it can be for sometimes the run-in can be, like, that battle can start 15 to 20 minutes out.
Wow.
And they're doing, they're swapping off, and they're just like sitting on 500, 600 watts, like surging. And, you know, sometimes they get a recovery because a teammate comes up and all this stuff, but it's everything, because quite often it's a real pinch point to get to some of these little goat path climbs.
Right.
And if your guy can start like third wheel, he saves so much energy. These bunches are like, you know, almost 200 men.
Yeah.
So if you have a bad moment or get caught up behind a crash on one of those climbs, the energy expenditure from the front guys who are sprinting up into those first few switchbacks and getting like the free ride, it's not a free ride, but they're like free run because they don't have any carnage in front of them.
Right.
So it's everything. And that becomes every climb. That becomes every finish, right? Like a GC guy also has to contend. He's not going for the sprint in the final, but he also can't get gapped. Because, you know, if the bunch is gapped by 5-10 seconds because someone sat up,
yeah,
that's a problem. So that means he has to stay in that front, like kind of 20 bits. So then as a domestique, you're riding as if you're doing a lead out. And if you have a sprinter, then you're doing lead out work for the sprinter. It's a very versatile job.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's something that a lot of people, like, they're looking at all these guys and they're thinking, like, why can't they go for the win? You know, like, I knew a lot of people back in the day, they'd ask me, you know, it'd be at the tour and they'd be like, well, why aren't you trying to win? It's like, we are trying to win, you know, always. But, you know, my job is not to win on these days. Like, it's not to win. It's that it's not really possible for me, but I'm good at other things. Right. And so, yeah.
It's funny, you don't notice. I mean, I think a lot of people might look at a world tour race and it looks so chill, right? Like, just that whole pack's moving so efficiently, and everyone's professional and everyone's well trained and everyone's like a quarter inch from everyone else's tire, and they just they're so on it and so focused, and it looks easy, but the mental bandwidth put into trying to calculate everything that's going on around you and trying to keep your person safe and get them to where they need to go through that group of riders without them crashing or running into someone, or then the mechanicals, and like, there's just so much at play, right?
Totally. And that's why like a race like the Tour de France is so mentally draining, because it's like the biggest pressure, the race everyone's looking at, that brings out a whole other element with a lot of the riders, with a lot of the teams, the pressure of that, like a lot of teams are riding on their sponsorship for the next year to do something at the Tour de France. And it's kind of like one of those things, is well known, you have a good Tour de France, sponsorship should be good again, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then, so what I'm noticing in your wiki timeline, like, looks like 2019, was that when you retired?
Yeah, 2019, yeah.
Yeah. And what does that look like? What does that feel like as a professional athlete? Is that hard to reconcile?
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. I always knew it was going to be tricky, but I didn't know it was going to be as tricky as it turned out to be. Yeah.
Like mentally?
Yeah. I mean, I think at first I was good with it. I'm fortunate because I love doing stuff. I'm like always riding. I still love ride. It's obvious maybe, but I really do love riding, you know, like it's still such a big part of my life. And, you know, I got kids and busy doing stuff. But you don't realize, well, I did realize, but I just didn't know how strong it would be. That kind of simplicity of that life. So what I mean by that is like your only job was to be ready, to be fit, to do your job. And that was a very, like, for me, it was a beautiful life because I was doing what I'd want to be doing, exploring on a bike anyways. So it was very, I never had troubles with motivation and training, you know. In my later years, I used to just throw the bike packing bags on the road rig and just ride across the Pyrenees and ride back home again, you know? And that's how I do my big volume blocks. Mm. That was paradise for me. Like,
yeah, and I guess everything's laid out for you, right? Like your program, like you said, you know, oh, you need to do whatever 1,000 K this week. I don't know what that looks like for training, but yeah, I mean, it's like, okay, what am I doing this week? What am I doing next week? You kind of know how much, like, is it even down to like the food you eat, the calories you intake? Is it all very regimented?
It is now for the guys. I was still in the kind of the little more old school area. It was really starting to change as I was making my way out, but I was just one of the older guys anyways. I mean, I was 42 in my last year of racing, right?
Yeah.
So it was funny because like no one harassed me. Like when all that stuff was coming in, I was like, I'm not doing any of that crap. Weighing food. Are you nuts? Like you guys have lost the plot.
Yeah. Lost the plot. Just eat as much as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. So now you tell me you're in the Pyrenees and you're already kind of, you know, into the bikepacking thing already. You're already packing luggage and whatnot. Was this your first dirt race?
No, I did the Buckshot.
Oh, right. Of course you did.
Earlier this year.
Yeah. We were supposed to connect. Yeah.
So that was kind of my first crack at like a longer, you know, and I was kind of like, it was like kind of a last minute thing. I was like, well, you know, I talked to some people that were doing, I was like, oh, Kamloops, my brother lives out there. I was like, we could do a family trip and I could just see what it's like to ride that distance, you know? And kind of just see what happens with the body and all of those things, that are very interesting to me. Cause I'm coaching some people and I'm very still involved in the sport. I still work with some riders that are racing at the World Tour and then all sorts of different people that are just trying to get better, you know? And so I like to still dabble and train and I love it, you know? So for me, the Buckshot was a thing just to go and see what it was like. And I was, as soon as I did it, I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. Because it's just like, it's this massive day out, you know? I love that.
I can't remember your time in the Buckshot. What was it?
I did it in 18 and a half hours, I think.
Yeah, a day ride. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it's funny because I did the Buckshot last year, and I've been wanting to do it for so long. I wanted to do the Buckshot for so long, and I was pretty much off the couch. And Megan Hakkinen won it that year. And I remember looking at her bike, and it's just like, oh, yeah, this is a day ride for her. Because I had things. I had stuff. Like, I don't know if I brought a pad. I can't remember. I didn't bring a tent. I ended up staying in a hotel, but when I got to Cache Creek, she was finished.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, man. Like, I think she had a top tube bag and a frame bag, and that's all she had. And I think her frame bag had a bladder in it. Like, and it's funny, it's all relative to your level of fitness, you know.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that's what I loved about it, is like everyone has their objective, their thing they want to do. Yeah. And it's going to be special no matter how you do it. Like, I remember just finishing, you're out in that parking lot down at the park and there's no one there. It's pissing rain.
It's not like a Tour de France, like, right?
Yeah. I'm like, this is awesome. Like, I think what really sold me on it was, and it's the same with the Epic, you know, it's just, I really like that vibe.
Man, I had my kids this week, and I was watching your dot roll in. I was like, oh man, I just want to get in the car. I want to drive over there and talk to you. And I couldn't get away, man.
Yeah,
just could not get away. Like FOMO. Tell me about the FOMO. Oh my god. Like, that's crazy. That's cool. So that was your first dirt shakedown ride. And then you go and destroy the Epic. It's pretty amazing. It's funny. I remember finishing an ITT of a shorter, like a 500K race. And I finished at like 2 a.m. in Invermere here.
Yeah.
And I touched the lamppost where I started. And I was just like, yay. And then I just had a bath and went to bed. There's like no one around.
it was funny because, I'll tell a little story from the Buckshot. One thing that was really cool was that whole final stretch back into Kamloops was where I won my first national time trial championships on that course.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's that road that kind of parallels the river, and it's just I remember, like, I was having these flashbacks of every undulation, and like it was all coming back to me, and I was just like in this really cool zone. And then you roll into the park there and you stop, and it's not until you step off the bike that you realize how buggered you are, you know. And My brother lives up the hill, and I'm like, oh shit, am I going to be able to like do this, you know?
The life of a bike pack racer. So when I finished the Buckshot, it was like I sat in the grass, ate a bunch of food, went to find my car, started it, sat in the air conditioning for like a half an hour with the car running. And then I drove 6 hours back to Invermere that night.
Oh, ouch.
And then when I got to Invermere, I could barely get out of the car.
Yeah. The body just seizes it.
Totally. I was so seized up. It's like there's no trophies, there's no money, you know, there's just hopefully there's just a lot of intrinsic pride and gratitude for being able to do something like that.
Well, I think, you know, I think that's what I love about it is that I think in a thousand, I mean, I'm new to this, so I'm not trying to spout off some knowledge here. 1,000K, nothing's gonna go, like something's gonna go sideways, right? And it's in those moments that you really deal with who you are and learn a lot about yourself. And you know what I saw very quickly is like, yeah, you can always quit. I don't have to do any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like there's a point out there where I was like, what the hell are you doing? You don't like
so you felt you that don't... too, hey? Crazy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, like there was a period because I buggered. So a side story here.
Yeah, of course.
When I was out at my brother's before, because we went out and visited the family before we went out to Merritt. I was just testing out the rig because I changed some things and I went bombing down this trail that ended up, I couldn't get out at the bottom. It was really steep descent. So I had to hike a bike back up, which is like I hike a bike all the time, but I was wearing different shoes that were really stiff. Anyways, I must have like kind of strained something in my calf/Achilles that wasn't a big thing. But then if you're going to go ride 1,000K in like pretty gnarly terrain, pretty rough terrain, well, it flared up big time. And my calf like basically ballooned up double. So when I was on the ferry with Miles and I actually laid down and got up again for that first time was when I realized how screwed my leg was. And then what was crazy is like, okay, when you got riding, okay, it was okay. It was not great, but it still moved and worked. But it was the descending. So the vibration was totally, it was painful. Like you wouldn't believe. And
you're clipped, so you can't move your foot, right?
So I was descending unclipped on that foot and resting my thigh on the saddle and just bombing it kind of in this awkward kind of side stance, you know, with all my weight on the other foot.
Just do what you got to do, man.
Yeah. And so it was just like every section I was like riding. And, you know, from that point on, it's like there's nothing really nice about a lot of those roads, you know. And when you're pedaling through that rough stuff, it's just, oh, it was painful. So like, yeah, that was a total point. I could have just said, ah, but then, you know, it's so humbling because you're like, I have this thing of like how the speed I need to move at. Mm-hmm. And I was just relegated to way less than that. And you're just like, well, you just got to keep moving. You just keep moving and that's it. You've committed to this thing. And you've put some effort into it. You got to finish it up. So, yeah. I was in a bad state the last, I'd say, 250K especially.
You know what? And I always found that when you roll through, is it Elko? When you kind of go by Elko, that you descend into the valley there, and then you're just climbing forever to get to Fernie, get to that pavement again.
Oh,
and it goes on and on and on. And you think you're there, you think you're, you know, oh, Fernie's just around the corner, but it's just like, it goes on and on and on. Yeah. And then you finally hit the pavement. It's just like, it's like the dopamine when you hit the paved.
Oh, totally, man. Like that's such a good, that's so where I was yesterday. I was cursing how much climbing on that road once you hit like Wigwam and you're making your way back over to Fernie up. But I'd ridden those roads ages ago, like in the Fernie gravel grind and that. Yeah. And it just seemed like it just kept going. Like you said, you just like keep grinding up and you're pushing and just feel like you're going, no, you're so close. Yet it just feels so long. Yeah.
When I did the yo-yo, I stood for 2 days and I was hamburger.
I believe it.
I was hamburger. Like I stood all of Great Creek Pass and then that whole ride out of Wigwam. It was just, yeah, I was standing the whole time. I could barely sit in the car when I got to the end. I was shredded.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I learned a lot on that. Yeah. Yeah. <I'll bet. laughs> Oh man. You know what? I haven't even said it yet, but congratulations. Like what an amazing ride. And probably just the beginning for you. What do you think? What's your next? What are you thinking?
Ooh,
what's next?
Yeah,
or you don't want to think
know.
About it.
Right now I'm just like kind of just enjoying. We just got home this afternoon and it's been nice to be home.
Yeah.
I don't know like if I'm, you know, this was kind of an experiment for me. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool because I saw a lot of things I could improve on. And again, all of these things, I think every time you do one, you learn a lot. And I love that because I think life is constantly about learning new things until you die. And this definitely is something that I really do love. Is it something I'm going to chase after like crazy? I don't know. I've spent a long time like doing these physical things and I love it. But I also know like you got to be careful how much you get into that, you know, like just from a health standpoint, you know, and it's because I've done, you know, years of grand tours and these things like that. Like I always say like, yes, sport and exercise, it's healthy. But at a certain point, I think it's also, you know, if you're not taking care of the other side of things, the kind of holistic approach, I think it can also be damaging too, you know? So I'm not sitting here saying like, oh, it's bad for me or whatever, but it's like, I think you just have to have a healthy respect for it. That's all.
I heard the idea thrown around a little bit that the pro tour, like these big European pro tour races actually take a little bit of time off your life.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, cause I find that can be very true. And I think I watch the racing now and it seems like at a whole other level again. It depends on your role, right? I think that was one of the things I realized early on is I had like as a younger guy, I won some pretty cool races and I was, you know, I was definitely, I could have gone either way and tried to hit the high peaks and chase after it like a madman. Or I could settle into a role that I knew I could have a good, healthy, long career, which still going to have its hard moments and probably, yeah, it's kind of things that weren't so healthy. But at the same time, you're living a life of, on the other side, it's like, it's a beautiful life. Mm. And I really got to cherish that. My wife and I, we made the most of our life in Andorra. When I wasn't racing, like we were just living a really nice life. So yeah, I think you mitigate that thing, you know, like I think it's true, but I think if your life is pinned in every other aspect, that's where it becomes dangerous. Because, you know, if I look at an endurance athlete, well, what are the side effects? Well, their heart rate or their heart grows bigger. That means it pumps more blood volume. And ultimately, it isn't having to work as hard all the time because you're just like a smooth running operation compared to someone who's living a not so healthy lifestyle, has stress and not eating healthily, where their heart is working hard all the time just to exist. So, yeah, as an athlete, you're pushing super hard through these hard acute moments. But then for the rest of the time, it's like your heart rate's sitting at 35. And yeah. So. Like I just feel like the body has this incredible way of just balancing everything out, but it's all within like treating it properly and trying to understand how you work right in these stressful environments.
I mean, I didn't ride the divide rapidly, but I had some blood work done the next month and my numbers were fucked. And the doctor was like, so can you tell me what your diet is like? And I was like, well, for the last month, I was living on gummy bears and orange soda. Yeah, basically, I was just like the high fructose corn syrup diet. It was in a food desert, right? So it was so hard to find food. So that's what I mean. It's I know like in the pro tour, I think your nutrition is a lot better balanced and managed than, say, in an endurance event where you're eating Subway and gummy bears for say even 2 weeks. So I guess it must be really hard on our mitochondria when you're throwing garbage down the gullet all the time, you know.
Totally. And that's another thing I learned here is just like that gas station food, it's hard to find anything of value. Because I never eat that stuff. I'm not saying I'm not against it or whatever, but like that was the first time I'd experienced like where I was just mainlining garbage food from the gas station. And you're like, you're not like, you just need calories, of course. But geez, there's not a lot of good options. And, you know, when I think of like what I try and eat at home and eating clean and all that stuff, it's just thrown right out the door when you get
things. Yeah, you can't find the food you want. I always say, like, I mean, obviously you're only out there for 2 days, but like on a multi-day thing, it's like if you can find one hot meal a day where you're eating just something, like some
totally
like bioavailable protein, you know, just something you can get into your body to give you some recovery.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's so valuable. Totally. How old are your kids, Fane?
3 is my daughter and 6 my boy.
3 and 6. Digging it? Digging fatherhood?
I do, yeah. It was always something. I initially, because I'd lived a life of just this bike racing thing, you become. You're just a baby. You don't grow. You're a baby yourself. It's just about you, and your performance, and your training, and your sleep, and all those things, right? And the best thing about kids is that all just gets. You get taught real quick, you know, like,
yeah, they become the narcissists. It's not you anymore. Yeah. It's them. Totally. It's all about them. Right.
And I think I really needed that for my kind of evolution as a person. Mm.
Man, you learn fast. Fuck.
Yep.
I found early, my kids are 9 and 11, and I found early childhood really difficult. I felt, you know, I was working, right. And I'd have the kids on weekends but it's like looking in a mirror of all your, like, they'll call you on all your bullshit all the time, especially now. Like, I find it easier now that they're older because I can reason with them a bit more. I think they're a bit more understanding. So when things go a bit sideways, you know, usually, you know, you can talk about it, talk it through at the end, and they're a bit more understanding it's a bit easier now, but I started late. I started 42. I guess you started around there too, right? Yeah. You started in your 40s. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. It's a late start, but yeah, I would say, again, you probably haven't listened to the podcast, but I really lean heavy into mental health, into men's mental health specifically. And it's like the trials and tribulations and the way we're tested as men and through fatherhood and the patterns that emerge through us, the way we were raised and the way we were raised as children by our fathers I had a great, my parents are still together. I didn't have there's no trauma that I'm aware of. You know, I was very lucky, very privileged with my upbringing, I think. But we all have little T traumas, right? And they come out when you have kids. You notice them. I think you're way more mindful about the way you behave and the way you show up day to day. So and then being an athlete, and I mean, such as yourself, and being away from home and racing and doing all that kind of thing, that adds a level of stress to the family and possibly to your partner that, you know, needs to be mitigated and addressed from time to time, I'm sure.
Totally. You know, that was a big reason why I stopped the sport, because, you know, in my last year with Green Edge, I was still performing at some of my best numbers. Like I wasn't, in some ways I was losing top end, but the other side of things like efficiency and kind of like, you know, we'll say like tempo type of work. Mm-hmm. It was the best I'd ever seen. You know, I rode the Giro that year and we nearly won we had the pink jersey for some crazy amount of days, and that's a whole other story. But my point was like I felt physically very good, but I just decided like we're you know we have my son, we're planning our second. And I'm, you know, at that point, things were becoming like training camp, grand tour, training camp, grand tour. You just were going for these month-long blocks away from home, right? And I was like, that's not what I want to do as a dad. You know, I don't know exactly what, you know, how I'm going to be as a dad, but I know not being there is not going to be a good thing. And so that was kind of, you know, the decision we made. And, but yeah, like you said, you know, a lot of that stuff really hits home. Like how I was raised is very different. I think I still have some of those traits from my father, but I think like I think a lot more about the words that you say and the impact that they have. And I think just trying to be aware of that. And cause I always try and remember like, why am I like this? Like why am I certain ways? Right. And so much of it were these really impactful moments when you were young, when certain things were said and, you know, like people call it trauma or whatever. I don't know. Like, I think there's people in life that really do have some trauma. I think it's a word that gets thrown around a lot that I'm not sure if it's really applies to a lot of the things that people are talking about, but that's just my interpretation anyways. But yeah, I think these words that you say to your kids are highly impactful. And so I try and be really aware. I wouldn't say I'm great at it, but it is something that I think about quite often.
I always try to like acknowledge them when they do stuff that I've been wanting them to do for a really long time.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I hate using the word training your kids. Right. But when we finish dinner and the kids take their plates to the sink, it's like, yeah, that's awesome. Like, thanks, buddy. Yeah. Thanks for doing that.
Totally.
You know, or hey, yeah, can you do recycling and not give me a hard time about it? It's like, yeah, nice. Thanks for doing that. You know, like,
yeah,
and acknowledging them when they show up in the way that you want them to.
Totally.
Yeah. But yeah, it's, I have a couple, coaches I talk to, my coach Seb, and he always has this, this thing he says to himself when things go a bit sideways, when he's dealing with his son, he'll pause. He always says to me, Steve, I want to invite you to slow down for a minute. I want you to slow down. Cause my brain's always just like, just a squirrel. Right. And, he's like, when things go a bit sideways with your kids, step back, take a moment, and remind yourself that you're a loving, kind, patient father, because you can lose, you can lose sight of that. And you can lose your grip on that sometimes when things go, your kids might not be to that point yet where they get really defiant and push back a little bit sometimes when you, they push back a little bit.
My boy's there, definitely. Like, you're just like, what are we, like, how did we get here? You know? And like, just like you're saying, you're getting ramped up.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're the one who should be able to like, see this big picture, right?
No,
but I find, like you said, if you can just step back a little bit and look at yourself, go, whoa.
Yeah, they
there's a different way to approach this, you know?
Yeah, and it's hard because when that starts, and when the momentum starts with some of those emotions or some of those, and I always use the word, the phrase showing up when you're not showing up at your best, and it's some, and then you're backpedal. And I've apologized to my kids a lot of times. It's like, I was an asshole, buddy. I'm sorry. I was being such a dick. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they're like, you were a bit of a dick, especially Jasper. He's old enough.
That's important. That's important because, you know, a lot of people aren't capable of doing that.
Oh, you have to acknowledge. You have to take accountability, like even as an adult. Like, and absolutely, you know, when you're trying to teach your kids about accountability at school, like if one of them goof off and they go to the principal's office, they come back and they're pissed off and the teachers are against me and blah blah blah, and it's like, no man, you have to be accountable for what happened there. Just like I'm accountable when I'm not showing up as my best, and I really try to make it right. And I think showing them that and you know, not brooding too long over it and letting days go by before, you know, I'm not talking to you anymore or whatever. That's like, I'm separated. I'm divorced, right? So it's just me. I'm outnumbered all the time. When I have my kids, I've got two kids, and it's hard. And they're both so different, right? They're so different in their activity levels, You know, I've got my apartments full of bikes, but they don't really like riding bikes that much. And it's like, oh, my God. It's like, oh. But I can't be that dad that, you know, like you probably can attest to this as a passionate cyclist. Like, imagine, you know, my boy, he fell off his run bike when he was very young and it shaped him. That was trauma.
Right.
That traumatized him. And I only got him on a bike like not last spring, but the spring before, like 10 years old. Right.
Yeah, they make up their mind on stuff, right? Ooh, and it's just, that's it.
And then after that, I got him on a bike. He crashed. It was icy. He fell in some water, and he was so pissed off. And I went to him, and I go, Jasper, I know you're pissed off. It sucks. You're wet. You're cold. I get it. I need you to do something. I need you to get on your bike. I need you to ride it back to the... No, I'm not going to get on my bike. You need to do this. Trust me. I need you to get on your bike and ride it back to the apartment. Fine. And he rides back to the apartment, gets cleaned up. Couple hours later, he's like, can I go ride my bike again? It's like, don't even ask, dude. Just take your bike and go ride it, please.
Yeah.
Ugh. And that was such a win, right? So despite all these, you know, just like a bike packing race, there's all these lows and these horrible things that happen. And there's always a high side. You always get to the top of Great Creek Pass, right? You always get to the top.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just so much better after that.
Totally. Yeah.
So I can't even see you anymore. It's so dark there.
Yeah. So I've been sitting outside here. So
yeah, it's great. So maybe just we'll start wrapping it up. What was like the biggest lesson you learned in the last two events you participated in on the dirt, the Buckshot and the Epic? What's like a big takeaway for you?
Yeah, we touched on it earlier, but I think taking on challenges, like, and whatever, like, whatever your objective is, whatever your goal is or whatever, but like taking it on 100% and giving 100%. And I think that's an important thing to do in life. And for me, like I said, I've done so much like physical things. There's no need for me. Like, I have nothing to prove. I have nothing to, like, you know, there's nothing really to gain in that sense, but I still believe it's so important to do, because we have this biology that was set up to do hard things. And I look around at the world now, and it's just like everyone's looking for comfort and to avoid any kind of hardship. And I think it's really important to, if you can, expose yourself to hardship every now and then, because it's just part of, like, for me, I'm not really satisfied unless I have a bit of that in my life. So I like these challenges, and, you know, I'll say from the Epic, I went through some dark patches and some very interesting things where I saw a lot about myself, but the kind of thing that I'm most proud of was being humbled by it and then just pushing on and just saying like, ah, fuck it. Like, this is the speed I can do now. That's what I got. That's all I got. So what are you going to do? Complain about it? Be mad about it? It's like, none of that's helping you right now. So just get her done. And so that was it. Yeah, it was painful. Yeah, it was not fun, you know, going through that Elko section where it's just puddles and it feels like you're doing figure eights out in a bloody field going nowhere, you know?
Yeah.
And then you hit that janky road just after or just at Elko, you know, the climb, you're just climbing up and down and going through that conservation area.
Oh, yeah. Where all the campers, like the rec sites are down through there. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's all over.
And yeah. So, yeah.
You know, I say that on the podcast all the time, the value in being uncomfortable and doing hard things. And I think also just learning what you as an individual are capable of, you know. Yeah. I'm not going to do the Epic in 2 days, but if I can do it in 3.5, right. And then execute in a different way. It's a win. It's like a puzzle, right? It's a bit of a game, right?
That's just it. I'm stoked for every person out there. Like, for me, that's my weird way of approaching it. I wanted to like do it in this way, but everyone out there has like their object, like, and I'm stoked for everyone who it just lines up. and takes it on, whether you scratch or do it in 10 days, like, it doesn't matter, because it's like, it's about the process, and like, it's still hard no matter, like, even if you take 10 days to do it, yeah, it's still hard root, yeah, you know?
Well, I was
going to have tough times.
I was talking to Justinus at the start of the Tour Divide, the morning of, and I had said to him, I had kind of said, and you could probably attest to this as well, but whether you're riding it in 2 days or 10, you're going through the same thing, right?
Yep, like
you're going through the same roller coaster. And what Justina said, he goes, no, he goes, actually, I think the people who are out there longer have it way tougher. They have it way yeah, harder. They're the heroes, because I'm going to be done. He's like, I'm going to be done it in 2 weeks, where there's yeah, another person who's going to take another additional 2 weeks. So they're going to get more weather, more peanut butter mud, more like just
totally
just yeah, more crappy food. Less like yeah, more awful sleeps, you know, it's yeah, and that was his take on it. So yeah, just doing hard things, man. We gotta push it. And I think when you come back to reality after doing something like, you know, what you just accomplished, and you look back on it and you reflect, it's like you make that first coffee press in the morning, and and you just realize like just how fucking good we have it, you know, in a lot of different ways. And just to show up with a bit of gratitude every day, and knowing that, you know, we've got a roof over our heads, and we have a family that loves us, and we've got our health and our fitness and our, yeah, we have a lot totally, going for us. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are all the things that become very clear. Like it's simplicity. Like it breaks all that down to the importance of life. Like what's important to you. And you just said it there. So yeah. Right on.
Well, Svein, I really was super stoked that we connected kind of short notice like this tonight. And congratulations again. It was amazing, amazing effort. And what's next for you? What do you got going on? You said you had a gravel camp?
Yeah, I put White Grizzly up at the ski lodge there in Meadow Creek. So yeah, got a full crew up there.
Nice.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I'm hoping the body comes around pretty quick here. Going to be right back to biking on the weekend. So yeah, looking forward to that. And a bunch of things scattered throughout the rest of the summer, but you know, mostly with the kids at this age, I'm just trying to be around as much as I can and enjoy these awesome days of summer, really. That's yeah, kind of the big goal.
Where are you located again? Are you in the Okanagan?
No, we're in just outside of Nelson.
Oh yeah, yeah, you had mentioned that earlier, sorry, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
right on. Yeah. Well, that's great, man. And hopefully we can connect. Maybe we can do a party pace bikepacking trip sometime.
Sure. Yeah.
Right on.
Cool.
Well, thanks for taking the time.
No worries. Thanks for the chat.
Absolutely. I'll reach out soon, okay?
Okay.
All right. Good night.
Take care. Good night.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. I want to thank Svein again for his time, and thank all of you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I really enjoyed that chat. It's so great. You know, sometimes I have to pinch myself that I get to talk to some of these pro athletes that come from such an extensive background. And I think it's funny. It's easy to look at some of these people and put them on a pedestal. You know, even like, you know, movie stars and rock stars and professional athletes and you know, it's such a privilege to me to be able to reach out to some of these people and talk to them. But you know what? They're just fucking people. We're all the same. Like, we really are all the same, and we all have great stories to share. And this was one of those stories. So it's fantastic. So thanks for tuning in. I hope you dug it. I want to thank some of the sponsors of the show. You know, I don't like, you know, I've got some great sponsors in this show, but they're very, I repeat them all the time, and I do it out of obligation because they support the show, and it's important. I need the support, especially in this time of unemployment and taking care of kids and you know, trying to build upon this podcast the best way I know how. And so the support from you and from my sponsors is so important to me. So for those of you who don't know, if you sign up on my Patreon at the $5 level, you're going to get early access to episodes. This episode here is probably going to be out a couple weeks before it goes public. So, it's important. Your support is really important. And this is a way I like to give back. Another great way to support the podcast is, if you don't want to become a Patreon, is just support my supporters. If you reach out to, or if you head on over to dynamiccyclist.com and you hear me talk about them all the time, they have an app. In the palm of your hand, you can have strength training, injury prevention, stretching, mobility, coaching sessions, all in the palm of your hand with the Dynamic Cyclist app. And if you sign up using the code MB40, you're going to save 25%. And you don't see discounts like that very often, 25%. You might see 10 or 15, but 25% is a great discount. And if you're not happy with the way you're feeling on the bike, you're not feeling strong on the bike, your mobility is suffering, really, sign up for a 7-day free trial, give it a go, and you're going to save 25%. So give it a go. Redshift Sports, use the same promo code MB40. You're going to save 15% off their products. So they've got their suspension stem, a whole new lineup of seat posts. They've got their Arclight Pro pedals. They've got the kitchen sink handlebar. They've got all sorts of great product. And if you're looking at really changing the look and the feel of your bike for better comfort over long distance, Redshift Sports is going to be able to set you up perfectly. So check them out, redshiftsports.com. Use MB40 to save 15%. Well, that's all I got this week. And for those of you who are my Patreons, you're going to get this one super early. So, and that's just a way for me to say thank you for supporting the My Back 40 podcast. And yeah, that's really all I got right now. Got some great guests coming up. I've got one on the back burner that is very evergreen that I'm hoping to get out soon. But there's been so much racing going on and so much awesome bike pack racing and events going on, and you know, Megan Hakkinen and Svein, all these people are just crushing these events. I really wanted to get some bike packing stuff out there, but I got some great mental health stuff coming up. So stay tuned. If you don't already, subscribe, share, rate, and review the podcast. Helps me grow, helps modify or helps tweak the algorithm so I show up more. But yeah, giving me a rating is a great way to support the podcast. If you're not in a financial position to, say, buy me a coffee once a month via Patreon, it's a great way to support the podcast, just rating and reviewing it. And also, you can also one time PayPal me if you want to tip me. If you really dug an episode and you want to chip in to the My Back 40 community, help me out, buy gas for the van, you can do that as well. And just check out my website, myback40.org. All right, that's all I got this week. So until next time, keep the rubber side down.